I'm here today with Michael Hinton. My name is Joyce Coleman. This is the second session in our interview with him. Our first session was February 9th, and today is February 25th, 2004. And in a short period of 2 weeks, it seems like we've gone from winter to spring.
Right.
Today we're going to focus on Bradley Learning Community and the International Learning Community. Last session focused on the Integrated Liberal Studies program and the Global Cultures program. But before we go on to today's topics, we're just going to pick up a few topics from last time. And the first of those is the Steering Committee. This is the committee which planned the reorganization of ILS in 1981. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about those Steering Committee meetings. Who was there, what you discussed, you know, the atmosphere of those meetings.
Yes, because I have fond memories of that year since it was so much fun and it was so exciting. I jotted down a list of the people in attendance, and they included Barry Powell in Classics, Gretchen Schaff in Engineering and Environmental Studies, Dave Lindbergh and Dan Siegel, both in History of Science, Charles Anderson from Political Science, Bob March from Physics, and Joe Elder from Sociology. And then a little bit later, the year afterwards, we were joined by Tim Allen in Botany and Bob Sack in Geography. Mm-hmm. And that was the group. Now, what was stimulating and exciting about those meetings was that we were really building a program from scratch, and it was a lot of fun. And we met once a week in Mickeljohn House, very casual, very informal, sharing our ideas, our philosophy. But the really interesting part came when we started doing drafts of the syllabi of our courses. And what I recall is that we agreed that each faculty member would promote and defend his or her syllabus to the rest of the group, and so we sort of all looked over one another's shoulders.
Okay.
And that was a very interesting experience. So here I was, as an English professor, looking over Bob March's proposal for a contemporary physics course and asking questions about it and mm-hmm. getting answers, and that process sort of worked like that for all of us. And at the end of the year, a couple of those faculty, in reminiscing, have said that was probably the most enjoyable and stimulating teaching year that they can remember, just because we were working through that process of building this interdisciplinary curriculum. And remarkably, we had no significant arguments. It was the atmosphere was really one of good fellowship, mm-hmm. There were lots of jokes and a lot of laughter. It really just was a great, warm experience.
And you all got to learn a little bit about each other's subjects, too.
We all got to learn a little bit about each other's subjects. You know, in the early ILS program, as I understand it, faculty used to attend one another's classes. And we just couldn't commit to that amount of time. But this was sort of a near second. And, of course, as years have gone on, that experience has retreated into the distance, and some of us have said, gee, are there ways we could recapture that experience? Mm-hmm. And in fact, just last week at our faculty meeting, someone suggested that if we had some donation money, maybe we could create a stipend or a fellowship to buy out a course for a faculty member each year so that person could attend all the other courses.
Oh, really?
And over the course of several years, maybe we could duplicate that experience.
Okay, and I know the courses all started out very coherent and talking about different topics at the same time, for example, in various courses. Do you think any of that cohesiveness has been lost, and would this type of experience allow people to sort of tighten the program?
I do. I think some of that has been lost over time as new people have come into the mm-hmm. program, looking at old syllabi and doing their own variations of it. It was
yeah.
great fun. I mean, for example, in the historical sequences, we would sort of say, well, in the literature and art course, in the 18th, 19th century, I'm going to be doing William Blake this week. What are you doing in history of science? Is there a connection? What are you doing in history of political economic thought? Should we juggle the syllabi a little so
yeah.
I do Blake the week before or the week after?
Yeah.
And it was great fun.
But also something a little bit difficult to maintain if new people come in.
It was difficult to maintain. And as I think I said in our previous interview, there's something unique about that first year of building a program
mm-hmm.
that is so exciting, so much fun, so rewarding, and really impossible to duplicate and sustain over time.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else once said that with these experimental or interdisciplinary programs, in a way, it's sometimes easier to create them than to sustain them. And I think that's very true.
Hmm. Now, some of the members of that founding committee, could you perhaps, you know, are there any of them that you'd like to comment on? Perhaps, I've forgotten her name.
Gretchen
Schaaf, yes.
I would, because Gretchen was a dear colleague who passed away in 1994. She died much too soon of a stroke. And was, I think, in terms of personality, the glue that held us all together. It's hard to describe her presence, but I still feel her presence when I walk into Mickeljohn House, mm-hmm. because she was the only faculty member besides the chair who had a permanent office in the building.
Okay.
So she was there all the time, and she was a warm-hearted woman with a deep-throated laugh and wonderful with students and a great listener, a very caring person. And she just sort of radiated good feeling. And those are qualities that are, you know, intangible and hard to duplicate. But she was the glue. If there were ever any slight danger of the rest of us getting into an argument or a dispute, Gretchen would sort of step in and say something funny and make us all laugh and withdraw, and then we would all be good friends again. So she was just a marvelous, marvelous woman.
Now, she combined ILS with engineering, which seems like a very unusual combination.
Right, like so many of the ILS faculty, she was unique. She, I think, finished a PhD in English,
mm-hmm.
and eventually got hired by the School of Engineering to teach technical writing. That's mm-hmm. what she was doing when she joined ILS. But her talents were much broader than that, and for mm-hmm. many years she taught a wonderful course called The Interpretation of Technology and Literature,
okay.
in which she had students reading novels about technology mm-hmm. and talking about that theme. So she was one of these interesting people who had appointments in several places on campus and who really brought a lot to the program.
Hmm.
The other thing about the group is that for all of our intellectual harmony, it was a very diverse group. We had conservatives and we had radicals.
Mm-hmm.
Politically and from every other point of view too, but they seemed to get along quite well. Bob March and Tim Allen were the wild men of ILS. But we had very staid colleagues such as Charles Anderson of political science and Dave Lindberg of history of science. And the amazing thing was we all got in the room and worked well together. More than worked well together. We had a good time together. And I don't know what the magic formula was. I think it was the excitement of working on this new project together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being able to start from scratch, that was so energizing that whatever the differences might have been in terms of personality or religion or lack of religion or politics, they all sort of disappeared and we really functioned well as a group.
And you all had a shared enthusiasm for undergraduate teaching and for interdisciplinary learning. So.
Yeah, that was it in a nutshell. That was our bedrock value that we wanted to advance. Yeah.
Are there any other comments you want to make on the steering committee? Any other personalities, perhaps, or
just that? As we've already said, it was hard to sustain and duplicate the energy of that first year, which really was unique. Although I tasted it again the year that we put together the Bradley Learning Community,
hmm.
because again we were building something from scratch. And that experience really creates a sense of ownership among the founders, I guess I can use that word. It reminded me of that year, 20-some-odd years ago, when we were revamping the ILS program.
Well, that will be a nice bridge to our next topic, which is the Bradley Learning Community. Now, you served as the co-chair of the Planning Committee in 1994 and 95, and then you were the faculty director in 95 through 2001. Can you talk a little bit about what the Bradley Learning Community is and how you became involved with it?
Let's start with the history,
sure.
How we became involved with it. We talked about the Mickeljohn Experimental College and how important it was as a model for us when we were doing ILS. But all along, my one regret for ILS was that we didn't have a residential component.
Mm-hmm.
And when this opportunity came up to do something in one of the dormitories, one of the student residence halls, I said to myself, maybe this is the moment where we could finally close the circle again and approach, if not duplicate, what Mickeljohn had done in the 1920s. Well, we did in some ways, and we didn't in other ways. But the way the Bradley Learning Community came about was The intercession of Chancellor David Ward. Now, I haven't mentioned David Ward, but David Ward was a wonderful chancellor and really had undergraduate education close to his heart. Mm-hmm. So, for example, David Ward, before he became chancellor, when I believe he was associate dean of the graduate school, was on the review committee for ILS when there was talk of terminating ILS. And he was one of the voices that said, let's continue it. It's a great idea.
Okay.
And that's how I came to know David. So I knew I developed a personal relationship with him before he became the chancellor. Now, a few years later, in the early 1990s, when he became chancellor, I understand that in his year of visiting the various branches of the university, he went to the residence halls and he sort of challenged them to defend what their part was of the campus educational mission. He said, you're not just a hotel service, how are you serving our students academically or intellectually? Why don't you talk to some faculty and see what you can do?
Do you know where he would have gotten that idea? I mean, why would it have occurred to him that housing should be more than an apartment service?
I think that one of David's driving bedrock beliefs was that although the university was diverse and had many different branches and many autonomous branches, the question we all should be asking was, how are we contributing to the education of undergraduates? And it was, I think, as a result of that, that he delivered that challenge to the residence halls. So the residence hall people started thinking about developing a kind of residential community for students. And the interesting thing was they began this discussion without any sense of an academic connection or any involvement in faculty.
Okay.
And so there was a committee that came to me in 1993-94, I think, and said, we're working on developing a learning community in one of the residence halls, and we'd now like to get some faculty input. And someone mentioned your name because you had been chair of ILS and you were now chair of the Global Cultures Program. We were looking for an academic link, and someone suggested that the Global Cultures Program might be a good academic link. So would you be interested in joining our planning committee?
Okay. And do you know the people who are on this housing committee? Do you remember any particular people?
Kay Reuter Crone, who was the assistant director of housing and who became a very close colleague as our plans developed. There was a representative from the dean of students' office, whose name escapes me right now. There were several other junior people in housing who had been working very hard on this program. Gwen Drury was one. A young woman named Beth Black was another.
Okay.
Whom I knew briefly because she had been a TA in the English department. She was now working for housing. And it was a fairly large community. There were some students on it. But the interesting point was, and actually it was a problematic point at the start, was that this process began autonomously within the housing division rather than beginning with faculty representing an academic point of view.
Okay.
And then we were gradually brought into the picture. Some friction developed, but we had a very interesting year, and I'll tell you about that in a second. But just to recap that conversation, when I was approached and asked if I'd be interested in joining the committee and asked what I thought about the idea, I was very excited because I said, here's our chance. I said, global cultures, certainly. We should bring global cultures into the picture, but we should certainly bring the Integrated Liberal Studies program into the picture. This is a natural for us.
Yeah.
That was something they hadn't thought of. And they said, well, fine, that's a good idea. And eventually we also brought environmental studies into the picture, because as these discussions developed, we all decided, that is the faculty and also the housing people, we didn't want to connect the dorm to a particular department.
Okay.
But what made sense was to bring in several compatible certificate programs that might interest students no matter what their majors would be.
Okay.
And I had already mentioned ILS and global culture. Someone mentioned environmental studies. And before long, we had faculty from these three programs on the steering committee. It was an interesting year because, as I said, the faculty came into the program thinking about the learning community as an extension of their academic programs.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all interested in what courses we were going to teach and how we would connect with students in an academic way. during that first year, the housing people, who to be fair, had sort of developed this idea, began to feel that the faculty might be taking over and changing their original plan, which was to create a learning community that would primarily be nurturing and deal with social issues and non-academic issues.
Okay.
And we began to have some back and forth on this committee. And somebody suggested that it might be, I'm trying to remember who, I can't take credit for this suggestion, although I did seize upon it. I don't remember who made the suggestion at one of our meetings. Someone suggested that maybe what we should do is have a retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And have the retreat coordinated and led by a neutral party.
Mm-hmm.
And someone had a person in mind who did retreats for professional organizations. And I immediately said, that's a good idea. I was the co-chair of the committee, and I think Beth Black was the other co-chair.
Okay.
And as I said, we began to have these various disagreements. And this turned out to be a very successful and exciting move. So sometime in the winter of that year, on a Saturday, we picked a day, we picked a place. I think it was the St. Benedict Center.
Oh, yes,
it was
I've
an off-campus
there.
Retreat. Neutral territory, and all of the faculty involved in the planning and all the residence life people involved in the planning and three or four students we had identified all came together for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a day-long retreat that turned out to be wonderfully successful, in which we were all asked to state our version of mission and goals and vision, all the different components, the students, the housing people, the faculty.
Okay.
And then in the afternoon, we had an exercise to see whether we could integrate these various points of view and come up with a mission statement, which we all agreed upon, and which we all felt was shared,
mm-hmm.
and a reflection of shared governance. And we did. It was actually a wonderful day. Now, one of the sidelights of that meeting was we each were invited to produce background material and handouts for people to read.
Okay.
And then I Xeroxed everything I could find about Mickeljohn's Experimental College.
Oh, okay.
And that became our reading matter for this conference. And it excited everyone.
Okay.
The faculty who really didn't know too much about Mickeljohn, the housing folks, the students, everybody thought this was a great idea.
Okay.
And we had a wonderful discussion. And at the end of that retreat, I think we had a mission statement, we had a vision, and our planning proceeded smoothly and rapidly, so that we shaped what we were going to do for the following fall,
mm-hmm.
sent out recruitment literature to students. My job was to recruit the faculty for the first year of the Bradley Learning Community. I now had a document I could take to them. In a way, it was very much like beginning ILS again.
Okay.
In fact, I went back to the same well, and a lot of the colleagues who had been working with me in ILS became part of the first year of the Bradley Faculty Fellows, but there were some additional faculty as well.
Okay.
When we opened in the fall, we invited David Ward, the Chancellor, Fall 95,
okay.
to speak to us at our dedication ceremony, which
mm-hmm.
he did. And we adopted as a motto one of Alexander Mickeljohn's favorite sayings, understanding is integration. And
hmm.
we have a plaque now on the wall of the Bradley Learning Community that has our motto from Mickeljohn. So there was that connection.
Okay.
So that's a little bit of the history.
Now, can I just ask one other question? Now, Alexander Mickeljohn, he's really the one who invented this concept of a learning community, is that right?
He did. In fact, as far as I can tell, he invented the term. In one of the documents describing the Experimental College, written in 1927, he uses the term a learning community.
Okay.
And I have not been able to find an earlier use of that term in my research.
Okay.
It may exist out there, but I think Mickeljohn invented it.
Okay.
And what he meant was clear. He meant not only an intellectual community, but a residential community,
mm-hmm.
where students and faculty were interacting both inside and outside the classroom on a continuous basis. And that's
okay.
what he meant by it.
Okay.
And that was the idea that we had, although we couldn't quite duplicate what Mickeljohn had.
Between the 30s and the 90s, what happened to this concept? And you said, for example, in the early 80s, you would have liked to have brought this component in, but you couldn't. Were there other schools who were doing this type of thing?
There were a couple of other schools that began to experiment with residential learning communities before the Bradley Learning Community. One of them was the University of Washington.
Okay.
Not the University of Washington, Seattle, Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington was
okay.
one of the first. I believe the University of Michigan and perhaps Indiana had a residential academic community a couple of years before we did as well.
Okay.
And I was aware of those connections. In fact, corresponded with some of the directors of those programs to find out what they were doing.
Okay.
And when they heard we were thinking of doing something on the Madison campus, they were excited because they had heard of the Micklejohn Experimental College, and they said, "You're finally going back to your roots."
But in the early 80s, you felt that that wasn't something that could be integrated into ILS?
No, in the early 80s, when we were redoing ILS, we talked to the residence halls, and there really wasn't any interest in doing it. And I think that's why the chancellor's intervention made all the difference.
Hmm. Okay.
Now, it's not that we did duplicate Micklejohn, because we didn't run our own courses in the dorm, and the faculty didn't live in the dorm.
Mm-hmm.
However, the faculty were a very important part of our concept for the Bradley Learning Community. First of all, the defining feature of Bradley was that it was going to be an all-freshman community.
Okay.
That's what the students were going to have in common. And what the housing staff and the faculty were going to do would be to help them transition from high school to college life.
Okay.
And we would do that through extracurricular activities, social activities, as well as academic activities.
Okay. Now, what were these academic activities?
Well, the plan the first year was to try to entice these students to think of joining one of the three certificate programs, so that after their freshman year in Bradley, because at the end of the year they would have to move, since
mm-hmm.
Bradley would always be a freshman dorm, they could continue to have maybe not a residential community, but an intellectual community in one of these certificate programs, whatever their major would be. So the first thing we did was we reserved spaces in the introductory courses in these three certificate programs for Bradley students.
Okay.
Most of the people teaching those courses were actually faculty fellows.
Okay.
We carved out some office space for faculty in Bradley so that faculty fellows could be there on a rotating basis and talk to students at odd hours in the evening or late afternoon.
Would that be like office hours, or would it be more social?
It never was clearly defined, and they didn't work out because students never knew what they were supposed to talk to faculty about in the office hours, and we dropped that concept the second year.
Okay.
It was a work in progress. But that was the faculty role, and
mm-hmm.
so we had the faculty in the first year. I have a list of them as well. We had from ILS Barry Powell, Joe Elder, Bob March from ILS. From Environmental Studies, we had Evelyn Howell and Cal DeWitt. We had Steve Bauman from Mathematics, Mary Leun from Global Cultures, Rich Ralston from Global Cultures and Afro-American Studies, and Judy Miller, who was in the French department and also in Global Cultures.
Okay.
And so that was the first group of faculty.
Okay.
But as the year went on, some things which we had hoped would happen didn't happen. That was disappointing. And other things began to happen on their own. And we learned that the students were going to define what the Bradley Learning Community was going to be, and it wasn't going to be just the faculty. And once we became comfortable with that idea, the program began to take off. But the first year was a little dicey.
Okay.
What we decided to do in the first year, or to try, we all agreed that we needed one common learning experience to try to build this community through learning. I mean, the idea was to build learning through community, community through learning. Another one of our mottos was to make the residence hall an extension of academic life rather than a retreat from it, as I recall. So the faculty were expecting honors seminars taking place in the res hall. And the students really didn't want that from us. As they told us after the first year, we get classes all week long with faculty. we wanted something else from you. We wanted to sort of break down the classroom structure and get to know you as people.
Okay.
Now, some of the faculty felt good about that, and others felt uncomfortable about that.
Okay.
If I'm not a faculty member, what am I doing there? I'm not a counselor and camp counselor or a cruise ship social director. why am I here? So at the end of the first year, a couple of those faculty dropped out because they felt that their academic identity was being submerged in the community.
Okay.
Others joined, though, on the understanding that we ought to give the students what they wanted from us and serve them in that way. The first year, what we did was we had a weekly learning journal class. Each faculty took about 15 or between 15 and 20 students, met with them once a week. Students kept the learning journal,
mm-hmm.
wrote about their academic experiences or wrote about various topics that were assigned for the week. We met once a week. They handed in their journal, not for a grade, but for academic credit. And we had a discussion based on their journal.
Okay.
The faculty thought that was going pretty well. When we did student reviews at the end of the year, they said, well, it was okay, but it was sort of like another class.
Okay.
And what they wanted was to see faculty in their environment, and as people, interacting as people, not as faculty.
They didn't want more homework.
They didn't want more homework, and that came as a slight disappointment to some of us who were hoping to duplicate the experimental college eventually with separate courses. But it turned out that that's not what the students wanted or needed. Other parts of the program were thriving. There was a real sense of community building among those students, and faculty showing up at extracurricular events and coming to dinner with students mm-hmm. and just getting to know them on a personal basis seemed to be the magic glue that made that aspect of the community function.
Mm-hmm.
And I should also add that besides the faculty and the professional housing staff in Bradley, we created a cadre of house fellows called peer learning partners. These were upper class students, juniors and seniors, who lived in the dorm and were kind of mediators between faculty and students, attending all of our classes and activities and working with the students to build community.
Okay.
And they became very important to Bradley because they were there all the time.
So they were more than just house fellows?
Yes.
Okay.
They were, well, we called them peer learning partners. The idea was everything we did in Bradley needed to have a learning component. It didn't have to have an official classroom component, but whatever we did needed a learning component.
Mm-hmm.
And once we redefined our goal in that broad framework, things began to click and work. And students began to come up with interesting events, panel discussions where they'd invite faculty in to talk about various issues, or dinner speakers, or extracurricular activities. We took the entire hall out to see Shakespeare at Spring Green, mm-hmm. for example, the outdoor Shakespeare Theater. That worked very well. And it became clear that that kind of activity, which doesn't duplicate what happens in the classroom, was what made Bradley go.
Okay.
You'd have somebody come in and sort of speak over dinner about the play they were going to see. We'd pile on a bus and go out to see the production, and we'd talk about it when we came home.
Mm.
That worked. We could do the same thing with film in town theme dinners and so on.
Okay.
So by the second year, we dropped the learning journal. And what seemed to work best was when we had faculty-student activities revolving around meal times.
Okay.
That was one time we were sure to get student participation.
They got hungry.
Big on hungry. And so the second year we moved to roundtable discussions over dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to be a workable model, which I think has become now part of the Bradley tradition and has been duplicated in the international learning community, which came along later. That seemed to work. So that first year was an experimental year. Things changed, as I say, and Bradley began to develop in its own direction. But it succeeded marvelously at helping first-year students find a home away from home on a big campus. That seems to have been the clue.
Okay, I think I might just turn over the tape because we're just... Now, you were just saying Bradley Learning Community helps students find a home.
The tendency is for the student to get lost just because the size of the place is so big. Mm-hmm. Very few freshman students had the temerity to knock on a professor's door during office hours.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we wanted to do in Bradley was to encourage them to see faculty as approachable.
Mm-hmm.
We ran some surveys at the end of the year to see how many students approached other faculty in their office hours based on their experience in Bradley, and there was a significant difference between the Bradley students and students who were in some of the other residence halls.
Really?
We also had fewer incidents of drinking and destructive behavior, which made sense because I think we had more of a community
mm-hmm.
there, and we had students looking after other students.
Yeah.
We also had a significant improvement in the freshman dropout rate in
mm-hmm.
that first year when we ran a survey. We had fewer students who got lost in the shuffle
okay.
than in the student population at large.
Okay.
So and I think those statistics have continued over the years. So it's clear that the idea of building community through the residence hall is not only a good thing to do to help students adjust socially to a large academic campus, but it also seems to improve their academic performance and retention.
Okay.
And the students seem to have a good time. Ultimately, the students knew each other within a month. They all 244 students, they all knew each other by name. And that doesn't happen in some of the other large dorms because those large dorms don't have the activities that bring all those students together.
Yeah. So not only are students getting to know each other better and to form a community, but they're also getting to know professors as people. And it sounds like getting to know professors and sort of being respected as an individual rather than just some statistic or some, you know, something that one gives a grade to.
Exactly.
Made a big difference.
Exactly.
To students.
And of course, one thing we stayed away from in Bradley was giving grades.
Mm-hmm.
And so we offered the student faculty roundtable experience for one academic credit, which I think was an incentive to attendance because it did mean something, but it was non-graded.
Okay.
So it was not threatening.
Yeah.
And we let students know that if they came and participated, they would get the academic credit. And so
okay.
we made it easy for them. And I think that that is a defensible academic decision to make as well, because you could see over the course of the year, getting to see these students close up, which is something I never had been able to do in my large introductory lecture courses. I mean, most faculty don't really get to know freshmen or hear what they're thinking. They
yeah.
see them in class, they're well behaved, but they don't
yes.
see them outside of class. I got to know a lot of these students, and by the end of the year, you could really see this amazing maturation process take place. Intellectually, also in terms of self-esteem or just how they carry themselves or
yeah.
their ability to have a conversation with a faculty member.
Yeah, yeah.
And to voice a slightly different opinion
yeah.
without quaking in their boots. These are the very real measures of success, I think, that Bradley and other residential learning communities can be proud of.
Yeah, it seems like even sort of speaking out in class in a situation where they are being graded, if they've had sort of practice when there's no pressure, that would help them to feel more self-confident voicing their opinions.
I mean, as faculty, we really had our eyes opened that first year and the second year as well in these small groups because students began to confide to some of the faculty what their personal problems were, particularly several of our women faculty sort of became magnets for some of the young women in Bradley who were having various relationship problems or whatever, and all of a sudden they were on call at all hours of the night, and they said, my goodness, I had no idea what some of our freshmen are going through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we see them in class on the Hill, they're at their best.
Yeah.
You know, they're wide awake, they have their pads and their pencils, they're attentive, and we don't know what's going on in their lives. But this was an eye-opener. I think we became aware of the pressures that freshmen face in a way that that was new to us.
Interesting. I mean, would that be drugs or alcohol? Or
For a few.
Okay.
Or personal problems, or parents getting divorced, or a death in the family, or an alcoholic parent. All sorts of things that we're sheltered from as faculty in our classroom relationship with students.
Do you think that has changed your own approach when you're teaching these large lecture courses?
I think I'm much more sympathetic when a student has a problem and or misses a class and comes in with a legitimate excuse.
Mm.
Yes, I think it sensitized me to what's going on. I think students have a tougher time in this generation than we did when we were growing up, for all sorts of reasons. Split families, drugs are two of the obvious things. Sexually transmitted diseases, all sorts of things that I didn't know about when I was an innocent student just coming out of high school.
So it sounds like the faculty learned as much as the students.
They did, and some of them didn't like it. As I say, we had a couple of very good faculty who said, I don't think I want to return next year because I'm not comfortable interacting with students at that personal level.
Okay.
What I have to give them, I have to give them as a faculty member in terms of my discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wish you well, but I don't think I'll sign up again.
Okay.
They were replaced by other faculty who were flexible and interested in connecting with students at that level.
Now, how much of a time commitment was this for faculty?
It was a pretty significant time commitment. At a minimum, it was a couple of hours a week interacting with their group, dinner and then a meeting. But Bradley began to develop a lot of student-generated activities to which faculty were invited.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'd get an email from a student group saying, we're all having a movie and popcorn Thursday evening and we want the faculty to attend. And so some of us tried to attend as many of these occasions as possible, but it did become a time commitment. On the other hand, the faculty were wonderfully loyal and devoted, and many of them felt stimulated and personally rewarded from this interaction. And so we had the same pattern in Bradley as we did in the revised ILS program. The faculty that began that program the first year, most of them, I would say 70% of them stayed,
mm-hmm.
and have continued to stay in Bradley every year that it's been in operation because they felt a connection and a sense of ownership to the program and feel and continue to feel that it's a very satisfying experience to connect the students in that way.
Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the other learning communities that were on campus at this time. I don't know if Bradley Learning Community was the first one, or...
It was.
There's also WISE, Women in Science and Engineering.
Women in Science and Engineering, I think, came online a year or 2 years after Bradley. I'm not sure now. As a program, not self-contained, but within one of the residence halls in Liz Waters for a floor for about 25 or 30 students, I think, with a very clear academic profile,
mm-hmm.
and that was to bring together students who had the same academic interest, science and engineering, to connect them to women faculty in those disciplines as role models and mentors, and to develop a set of activities that would be appropriate and energizing for that group of students.
Okay, so it was a much smaller program and it really didn't have a connection to Bradley.
It had no direct connection, but once Bradley got ahead of steam up, the Division of Housing quickly saw that these residential learning communities were magnets,
mm-hmm.
for student recruitment and that they were really serving a purpose. And so Paul Evans, who was the Director of Housing, who came in at just about that time. I think Paul became Director of Housing the year that Bradley was started.
Okay.
He became a great champion of the learning community and has spent a lot of time and resources working with faculty to develop other learning communities.
Okay.
The Chadbourne Residential College is a notable example, which is the largest learning community. That came online the year after Bradley did.
Okay.
With a similar mission, although it didn't have a core group of faculty attached to it, but it did have a group of faculty rotating in and out to give talks and participate in panel discussions. And that's a much larger, because it occupies the entire building of Chadbourne Hall, it has up between 600 and 700 students in it, I think.
Okay.
Not freshmen, but mixed.
Okay. Now, I'm interested to hear that the undergraduates were excited about going to lectures in the evening. I mean, as long as there wasn't that sort of grading component that made it feel like homework, that they would happily show up to talks that people gave about theater or about other or political topics, perhaps?
The more these talks were tailored to their personal interests, the better the attendance. They wanted to hear from faculty about their own experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one of our most successful evening events, as I recall, was an evening in which several faculty who had been on campus during the Vietnam War years had a panel discussion on what it was like to be in Madison in the 1970s. And the students really were interested in hearing that because they were talking to people who were there. In fact, we showed a documentary film called The War at Home, which is about the Madison riots and the Vietnam turmoil and the National Guard coming to Wisconsin and so forth. And then we had a panel of faculty to answer questions about what it really was like. And then the faculty, of course, were interested in talking about the political issues on campus. That was a terrific event. We had that in the evening in the basement of Bradley Hall, so students didn't have to leave the building for the lecture. All they had to do was come downstairs. And those were the type, that was an example of the type of activity that really was successful in the learning community.
Okay. And what about some of the social activities that students planned?
Oh, well, we had a full range of social activities. We had a student planning committee. Each year they came up with different events. For a couple of years we had a very successful monthly coffee house where we had amateur entertainment. If somebody played a guitar or did imitations or whatever, he or she would be featured as the talent, and we'd drink a cup of coffee and then interact socially. Films, movie nights, special dinners, dances, Halloween pumpkin carving, whole range of activities. Aaron Brower, one of our faculty members who has since succeeded me as the director of Bradley, came up with something called Jackson Pollock Night, where we had a huge canvas. Students collaborated on an abstract painting. It turned out pretty well, and I think it was on one of the walls for a year or two.
Perhaps not as valuable as an original Jackson Pollock.
But no, but
more fun to make.
But it was fun, and as time went on, the students began to sort of seize the initiative and generate more and more of these activities, which really was great. And it seems to me that what makes one of these learning communities successful, more so than planning from the top, is faculty presence but student-generated activities. That seems to be a formula that works or has worked in Bradley over the last few years.
Okay. Now, back to the academic component just for a second. You said originally the idea was that students would register in ILS, Global Cultures, or Environmental Studies. Did that, in fact, take place? Do you find that most students...
It did, but the numbers were small.
Okay.
And for those students, I think the idea worked out as we had planned. It was very beneficial. They went on to take certificates. But they never represented more than a fraction of the total population of Bradley. And since our basic idea was to try to come up with a common learning experience, it became clear after the second year that those three certificate programs per se couldn't provide it. What we tried to do in the second year was come up with one course that might provide it, and that was Critical Thinking and Expression, which was an ILS course. We reserved, we created a second version of that course just for Bradley students, and didn't quite fill it up, therefore had to open it up to the rest of the campus to fill. But it worked pretty well. I think we had two-thirds of the enrollment in that course from Bradley students. We tried it again the second year. The enrollment dipped a little bit. And by the third year, we decided that wasn't the venue either.
Okay.
Because we were serving a segment of the community, but not the entire community.
Okay.
So my dream of recreating the Micklejohn College, where every student in Bradley Hall would be taking the same course, remains a dream that is still to be fulfilled. And maybe it's not the model for the 21st century, given all of the various activities and distractions on campus.
That could be the case. I suppose back 60 or 70 years ago, students had very little choice in what courses they took. Now students are used to choosing whatever they want to, and maybe it is more difficult to get them to register for a strict set of courses.
I think that's true. I remember one of Micklejohn's sayings was, in his definition of a college, someone asked him, well, what's a college? He said, a college is a group of people, all of whom are reading the same books, which I thought was a brilliant statement of community and learning. So we had book groups in Bradley, but again, we had maybe 10 or 12 students sign up for the book group, and we were not serving the entire population. So for me, that still remains a dream unfulfilled, and whether it ever can be fulfilled or not, I don't know. On the other hand, Bradley has become a roaring success. It fills up every year. The students have a wonderful experience. There is student-faculty connection. Students are learning in Bradley. It's like having children. They turn out the way they're going to turn out. And if you're a good parent, you sort of let them become who they are. So I think that's what's happened with Bradley. And it's turned out a little differently than the parents thought it was going to turn out. But I think it's been a roaring success.
Okay. Now, do you still have any involvement with Bradley?
I did until 2 years ago when I began working on the International Learning Community.
Okay.
Which was a new project and couldn't do both at the same time.
Okay, well, please talk about that a little bit.
Well, based on the success of Bradley, the Housing Division was interested in additional learning communities, and in some discussions with Paul Evans, we agreed that an international learning community might make sense. We have a lot of international students on campus, a lot of students who study abroad, a lot of students who are studying foreign languages. That might be a natural cluster of student interest which hasn't been tapped. And we have a lot of faculty on campus who teach in an international studies area, whether it's a language department or an area studies program. Or the International Studies major, or the Global Culture Certificate. So we had an identifiable group of faculty and an identifiable cluster of students, and the Housing Division said, well, we're willing to give that a try. I was still Associate Dean of International Studies and had a great support and enthusiasm from my boss, the Dean of International Studies. I said, this is something I think that might be good for us. And he said, go ahead and try to work on it.
So the idea then came from Housing and they approached you, or did you develop the idea together?
We developed the idea together.
Okay.
As the director of Bradley, I was involved in discussions of future learning communities. And I don't recall whether I suggested the idea or somebody else did. It's funny, those things become hazy in one's memory.
Yes.
I just remember that the idea was brooded, and I said, that would be great. Why don't we do that?
Okay. Now, you were on the planning committee 2001, 2002, and then you were faculty director 2002, 2003. What type of planning took place in order to get this functioning?
Well, pretty much based on what we had learned about the planning process for Bradley and what worked and didn't work in Bradley, we tried to constitute a planning committee with representative faculty who would be faculty fellows for the first year in Bradley. But we were beginning on a smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
Housing was willing to carve out a couple of floors in one of their dormitories for the ILC. And lo and behold, the dormitory selected was Adams Hall, which was the home of the Micklejohn Experimental College.
And so, that was by chance?
It was by chance, but it was a wonderful coincidence.
Yes.
Because here the wheel was now coming full circle. In fact, when I told some of the Micklejohn alumni, the surviving Micklejohn alumni that we were going, who followed Bradley very closely and who came out several times during the year to talk at Bradley, when I said we're going to try another learning community in Adams Hall, they were very pleased and excited. So we decided to try to invent the international learning community along the model that had worked for Bradley. And that was to involve a group of faculty with students in the ILC. We created a vision and a mission statement and a brochure, which we marketed to the study abroad students and students in certain disciplines and international students. And we set up the first year based on the Bradley model, which would be a weekly dinner with students and faculty with a speaker on a topic of international interest, followed by discussion. And then a workshop in the second week, in the alternating week, where the faculty member would continue meeting with the same group of students at his or her dinner table to continue discussion on that or maybe a related topic.
Okay.
And we also created a student planning committee for social and extracurricular activities, each with an international theme. such as an international dinner,
mm-hmm.
or attending a theater or film event that had international or other culture context. Opened our doors last year for the first time, 2002-2003.
Okay, now is this restricted to freshmen or for all students?
Actually, we decided that probably we would exclude freshmen this time around.
Okay.
And so it would be for students who were sophomores and above, who wanted to live in the community and participate. At the same time we opened the community, we learned of a separate initiative coming out of the German department to create a language floor in one of the residence halls, which could be a German floor,
mm-hmm.
In which students could speak German on a daily basis and practice their language.
Mm-hmm.
Once the planning committee learned about that, it seemed natural to negotiate a partnership, and
yeah.
we did, and we invited the German floor to become part of the international learning community, which they happily agreed to do. And opened with a German floor and three other floors in Adams Hall last year for a total of about 65 students. We opened
okay.
on a small scale.
And just to compare, a Bradley Learning Community was how many students?
Bradley was much bigger. It had spaces for about 240 students.
Okay, so a tenth of the size.
Although we're hoping that the international learning community will grow over time and expand.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps at some point taking over the entire residence hall, although it's too early to say if that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that worked well in that last year was the connection between the language floor and the rest of the community. The Spanish department, becoming envious of the German floor, came to us with a proposal to establish this year a Spanish floor,
mm-hmm.
which we eagerly accepted, and so this year we have a Spanish floor as well as a German floor.
Okay.
The Italian, French and Italian department now are talking about an Italian floor. They have a separate French house. So I don't know where this will go. It may be that as time goes on, the language floor component will become one of the most significant defining features of the international learning community. That depends. We were a little disappointed in that in the first year and also in the second year, we did not succeed in attracting a great many international students on campus, and we're in the process of trying to find out why.
Okay.
Whether they felt for some reason or another that they wouldn't be comfortable in the ILC, I don't know. We had a handful, but that's a big population, international students.
Was the goal to have maybe half international or mostly international?
Our goal was to have an equal mix of international and domestic students.
Okay.
And we may yet achieve that. But
okay.
We weren't there in the first year.
And
you know, you create a program, and it's hard to say who's going to come.
Yes, yes.
And so the students who came, besides the students interested in the German floor, were international studies majors, students who had studied abroad and just wanted a friendly venue to return to, students who were thinking of study abroad,
mm-hmm.
or students who had gone abroad in high school under a Rotary program.
Okay.
A mix of students, a very diverse mix of students.
Okay. And those who were living on the language floors, did they tend to be native speakers in that language, or were they learning the language?
No, they were learning the language, but the German department hired a native speaker, one of their teaching assistants, and that teaching assistant position was devoted to the language floor. So that
okay.
person lives on the floor with the students and holds daily discussions with the students in
okay.
German, and is receiving both a housing stipend for the room and a TA ship.
Okay, okay.
It's an interesting model.
Yes, yes. So there's no sort of academic component in the same way? There's no encouragement that they take a particular program or to enroll in certain courses?
There's encouragement, but no compulsion.
Okay.
And so we have certainly publicized the Global Culture Certificate. Several students, in fact, are now enrolled in the Global Culture Certificate program.
Okay.
We, of course, feature study abroad.
Mm-hmm.
We're a good source of information on study abroad. We're a good home for students returning from study abroad who want to continue to live in a kind of international environment. We've got a range of activities besides our faculty-student dinners, similar to those in Bradley, social, extracurricular activities, but we don't have a three-credit course or a one-credit course. We do have a one-credit course, which is the roundtable course, but we don't have a three-credit course dedicated to the program. Because with upper-class students, it's increasingly difficult to get students to commit to a separate course based on what's happening in their residential community.
Yeah.
That's the difference, I think, today, between today and Nickel John's day.
They have majors and they have to fulfill
those
requirements.
They have majors, they have requirements, they have interests outside the residence hall.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to sort of make that central course the academic component.
Okay.
But what is our academic component, as in Bradley, is this continued presence of faculty fellows mm-hmm. interacting with the students over dinner, panel discussions in the evenings, special events focused on international awareness and international activities.
Okay. And who are some of the faculty members who have become involved with international learning community?
Ruben Medina from Chicano Studies and Spanish, Joe Elder. From all of the programs.
He becomes involved with everything.
Joe becomes involved in everything. Harold Shoib from African Languages and Literature. And we've had several other faculty fellows sort of rotating in and rotating out. Mary mm-hmm. Leung from Comparative Literature.
Okay. So in this case, there's not a huge commitment to show up to multiple events a week. It might be more coming to give a talk and then discussing with students.
Well, there is a commitment to come to dinner once a week and to have a separate meeting with students in the alternate week. So there
okay.
is that once a week contact.
Okay, I see.
Aliko Sangalo from the French Department in African Studies is also attached to the ILC.
Okay.
So we have an interesting group of faculty.
Hmm. Do you think there are any changes that need to be made to the program in the future, or is it too soon to tell?
We're still in a building phase. I think that we have a more disparate group of students in the ILC than we do in Bradley. In Bradley, all the students have in common the fact that they're freshmen,
mm-hmm.
and that is a very strong bond.
Yeah.
By the time students become juniors and seniors, that bond is a little harder to build. So I don't think we're quite there yet in the ILC with building that strong community sense.
Okay.
We are seeing the development of neighborhoods within the larger community. The Spanish floor is bonded, and the German floor is bonded,
mm-hmm.
and I think the challenge is to keep these language floors integrated with the rest of the community.
Yes, yes.
And it's not easy to do that, so we're still searching and experimenting.
Certainly.
The other challenge, I think, is to recruit more international students.
Mm-hmm.
We really should be seeing a higher number of those students become part of our community.
And have you done surveys or any?
Just anecdotally. A lot of international students have international student groups on campus that become their homes. And most of them live off campus.
Okay.
That gives them an opportunity to cook their own food.
True.
And to live with people from their own country.
And perhaps if they're paying international tuition, then saving money is quite important. So.
Well, that may be another issue as well.
I don't know.
But we need to do a better job reaching out to them.
Okay. Well, in the spring of 2003, you gave up your position as Associate Dean of International Studies and to return to full-time teaching. What prompted you to make that decision?
We had a change of regime in the office. The dean stepped down, David Trubeck. We had a new dean who came in. I had been doing the job for 12 years. It was an initial three-year appointment, so I had been in there four times longer than was expected. And it seemed to be a natural point for me to rotate out and to
okay.
let the new dean choose someone he wanted to work with to advance his new initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
So I've remained I have a very cordial relationship with the new dean, and in fact I'm still doing some consulting work for the Office of International Studies and Programs.
And who is the new dean?
Gilles Bousquet, who
okay.
had been chair of the French department.
Okay.
Who's doing a wonderful job and is a terrific successor to Dave Trubeck.
So to what extent have you remained involved with ILS, Global Cultures, Bradley, and International Learning Community?
Well, I'm still, I'm not directly involved with Bradley at the moment, but I'm still attached to the ILC.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still the chair of the Global Cultures program, and
okay.
I still teach my course once a year in the ILS program, so I suppose I haven't wandered too far away.
So you've left some of the administrative duties and sort of kept the teaching duties, the
right.
fun part.
Right, right.
Now, how do you, when you look back on your career at UW, initial period as an English professor, and then all of this time spent with these new programs, how do you regard the role that administrative work played in your career?
Well, it's not what I planned to do when I went to graduate school, but looking back, I think it's probably the most significant part of my career has been my administrative work in building these new programs, or reworking ILS and building these learning communities. It seems to me not only has this been the most satisfying work I've done, because I can see these programs continuing long after my retirement, whereas my teaching and my articles in print will be gathering dust somewhere in the great beyond. I have a real sense of accomplishment in having worked with other faculty members to create these programs. And so as much as I've loved teaching and as interested as I've been in research in my area, which is modern drama, I think my...
Now, as you prepare to return to English full-time, do you have any particular goals, any ambitions you hope to carry out?
To be perfectly honest, I'm very close to retirement.
Oh, okay.
And my plan is to spend my last year on campus, which is going to be next year, teaching, which is what I did my first year here, to sort of complete the circle. So I'll be teaching a full load of courses next year, and I am now anticipating retiring at the end of the 2004-05 academic year.
Oh, well, the university will miss you very much,
well,
I'm sure.
Thanks very much. I intend to stay in town and may well, you know, post-retirement have a connection of some sort to particularly these residential programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just wondering if you had any general thoughts on the value of a broad liberal arts training, especially these days we keep on hearing about specialization and job preparation. Why is liberal arts so important?
Well, if I hadn't had a broad liberal arts training myself, I'd be selling furniture, which is what my dad did. So the purpose of a liberal arts education is to open doors, I think, and to enrich your life and to lead you down paths you never imagined possible before. I keep going back to Mickeljohn. He has been, you know, speaking from the grave in his writings, the great inspiration of my educational career. And again, he would say the purpose of a college education is not to prepare you for this job or that job. That happens after, you know, you take a job. The purpose of education is to teach people how to think and to assume responsibilities in a democracy that they will have to assume if the democracy is going to function well.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he kept going back to Athenian society as his model. And I really believe that. I think the function of education is to teach students how to think, not what to think, and not to prepare them narrowly for this or that profession, because first of all, people change jobs every few years nowadays at the drop of a hat. So if you're narrowly trained, and that's all your education amounts to, you will be at a disadvantage later in life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you learn how to think and to critically analyze arguments and to write and to communicate orally, you can do almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
I would throw in study abroad as a must experience, because thinking about broadening experience, nothing can do as much for you in such a short time as having to function and work and think overseas in another culture, in another language.
Mm-hmm.
It is just the most astounding educational experience possible. And our students who come back from study abroad say that again, that it was the best thing they have ever done.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to navigate in another culture. It brings you to maturity much faster than any other experience I know of. Gives you self-confidence, gives you a whole new set of intellectual skills if you're learning another language. It allows you to look back at your own country from a distance and to get some perspective on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically makes you step out of the box of prejudice and assumptions and training that you've had growing up in one place at one time, and
yeah.
It opens a new way of looking at the world.
Well, it's interesting, this idea for preparing people for sort of public life and perhaps political life, because even in the original alumni of the Mickeljohn College, many of them went on to quite astonishing careers. Are there any of them in particular that you'd like to talk to about?
They were an extraordinary group. Some of them did go on to prominent careers, and others just became very involved citizens. I mentioned Filio Nash, who became an aide to President Truman and then the Secretary of Indian Affairs, or the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the Kennedy administration. Wilbur Cohn, who was an alumnus of the Experimental College, became the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, as it was called, in the Johnson administration. And I got to know Wilbur well before his death. He would come to all of our meetings. I once asked Wilbur Cohn, what was it about the Experimental College that had a lasting effect on him? And he told the following story. He was in Johnson's cabinet, and Johnson was at the decision point of whether to expand the Vietnam War or to keep it going, and it was not going very well. No. He had already made that decision, and things were going badly, and nobody in the cabinet had ever challenged him. And he, Wilbur remembered a cabinet meeting in which Johnson asked around the table, any questions? And Wilbur said, "Mr. President, why are we in Vietnam?" And Johnson got all flustered and delivered a not very coherent, angry answer, and let it be known that that was not a question he wanted to entertain, and nobody else had ever raised it. And he said, "It was my training in the Mickletown Experimental College that led me to make that remark." besides Wilbur, there were very successful businessmen. There were some novelists. There was Dave Parsons, who became a sculptor of some note, and in fact designed the Mickletown plaque for us, which is now attached to Adams Hall, which is quite interesting, where the International Learning Community is now housed. And then there were some people who went into private life. Manny Lerner, who was a businessman and who was very active in the Alumni Association. Harold November, who also ran a small business and was very active in the association. Bob Fraze, who actually did go into government and worked on the Social Security Act and was a prominent economist, was an alumnus of the Experimental College. Walter Brecker, who was very active in the Alumni Association, I believe was a theater manager. He managed the Apollo Theater in New York City.
Really?
So, I mean, these men, since they were all men, went into various walks of life. Some became prominent, some didn't, but they all remained passionate about education and passionate about what happened to them in their freshman year. And that, to me, was the most remarkable thing about them. I mean, how many people are passionate about what happened to them in their freshman year? I said, there's something there we ought to look into.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like through all of these programs, they've given students a real excitement about learning, and they've really tried to broaden their horizons a lot.
Well, teaching is not learning. Learning is something that happens within the student. And we can be prepared as teachers, but if we're just teaching, that is sort of talking intelligently, we're not necessarily triggering learning. We've got to come up with inventive means of interacting directly with students. It's hard to do that in a big lecture hall.
Yeah.
You can be the most brilliant lecturer in the world, and you're not connecting one-on-one with a student, and learning takes place in that connection, in that link. And that's why these learning communities and undergraduate teaching programs like ILS and the Mickletown College have been so important. And the wonder is that they have thrived in the belly of the beast, in the heart of a big research enterprise such as the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Because undergraduate education is really not at the center of what we do on this campus.
Yeah.
It's important, but it's not at the center of what we do in terms of the reward system of the college.
Yeah.
It's research. And the challenge is to connect that intellectual life that faculty members have through their research with this personal link with students to make the excitement of research occur on an undergraduate level through the learning process. That is probably the most difficult challenge we have as faculty members, and yet the most rewarding if we succeed in accomplishing it.
When
the light goes on in a student's eyes, it's worth, you know, 10 times the articles you've published in learned journals.
Well, do you have any final comments on anything we've talked about? Or anything?
Oh, I think I've been far too long-winded, and thank you for seeking me out and your attention.
Oh.
I appreciate it.
Yes, well, thank you very much for your time.